Lyndon Barois tells us, "While in high school, my father constructed a prop of Prince's Telecaster out of plywood for a talent show in which he and two friends lip-sung and performed the song Do It All Night in 1980. I recall marveling and playing with the fake guitar as a child. There was something magical about it, that the fake could contain just enough associative personality to facilitate a transformation. The likeness of an object giving power to its copy. An image of an object trumps the actuality of it." So while this may be a playful memory of a young fellow making fantasy music and imitating his dad, ultimately imitating Prince, the mature artist Barois now is sees something deeper in his playing with plywood in those early days. Barois might call what he was doing with his talent show Telecaster miming the real into being, as if somehow the copy has assumed the character and power of the original guitar. The representation, the power of what's been represented, as Michael Taussig says in one of his anthropological studies. And while it is copying in the broad sense, it's not slavish imitation. And it can create a space for something new that may be filled with fresh energy and ideas, and that may even invite us in. There may, in fact, have been something theatrical in a fundamental sense about young Lyndon's teasing us with his plywood Telecaster in the very fact that he wasn't actually creating music. In a certain sense, real behavior became symbolic behavior in that way, giving us a chance to reflect on the whole experience. And he found he could extend the experience to something he loved as much as music, and that's the game of basketball. Another kind of playing. What happens when the real behavior of playing basketball becomes symbolic behavior in an artistic context? It's like what Robert Thompson describes as art in motion. Things done, sculpture and dress combined with things happening. And a fundamental principle is made manifest. Action can be a superior mode of thought. Movement can serve the imperatives of life with sensuous uprush and spontaneity. The artist transcends particularity to illustrate with authority vital grace. That from Robert Farris Thompson in an essay titled African Art in Motion, sculpture, dress, costume coming together with movement. Seth Lewis tells us, in its seventh iteration, the Great Rivers Biennial, a collaborative effort between Contemporary Art Museum St. Louis and the Gateway Foundation, showcases the work of three talented emerging or mid-career artists based in St. Louis. In addition to providing them with a major exhibition at CAM, the biennial awards all three artists a $20,000 honorarium to help jumpstart their artistic careers. And Lyndon Barois Jr. was one of those honored in the most recent biennial. Seth Lewis tells us, in the exhibition Of Color, Lyndon Barois Jr. deconstructs racial identities through the use of life-size assemblages and the installation of an outdoor basketball court in the gallery space. The assemblages, or pieces of sculpture, are composed of used toner boxes and freestanding cutouts taken from popular print media imagery. And Barois tells Lewis, "I was thinking about my own relationship to courts growing up playing on them, understanding how formative a space the outdoor basketball court can be, and recognizing the culture that gets built around them is quite complex. I think about the And One mixtapes from the late 90s when the athletic apparel brand sponsored the wide release of these video mixtapes, a compilation of street ball tournaments in New York City set to music. It set the culture of street basketball ablaze. It was a move from the league and a more formal relationship to basketball and made it this whole other thing. Rules were being broken and gameplay was stylized. Suddenly, people weren't emulating NBA players. They were emulating these guys who they can go to the park and see. And then even that became formalized and corporate as well. Still, that shift from the exclusive to the accessible became important in thinking about the overall culture of basketball The fact that anyone could play the game became a lot more real for people. Words of Lyndon Barois in an interview with Seth Lewis for KDHX. Lyndon Barois Jr. has brought the exhibition of color to the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre at the invitation of gallery director Heather Sienkiewicz. And we're invited onto the court to interact in the space with the players, sculptural though they are, thinking perhaps, as Barois will describe for us, of the poetry in motion of Michael Jordan, who could adjust to and transcend limits and bring us as humans an expanded sense of possibility. Lyndon Barois creating for us as viewers an experience that might just challenge limits and change ways of speaking, thinking, doing that have too long robbed us of the freedom to be human to the full extent of our powers and yearnings, in the words of Jerome Rothenberg in Symposium of the Whole. Lyndon Barois Jr. paid a visit to the WVIA studios with Heather Sienkiewicz, director of the Sordoni Gallery, to talk with us about the exhibition of color and how he came to his work as an artist.
My father's an artist as well, and so that kind of activity was always pretty familiar to me and encouraged, even though it wasn't until much later that I decided it's something I wanted to pursue. I was actually more interested in sports and athletics, like probably, you know, through the first half of high school. But I would say as early as probably fourth grade, I realized that like I could draw. I had some kind of proficiency in making something. Wasn't till, gosh, probably my junior year of high school that I was like, oh, maybe I want to take this seriously.
What were your favorite sports?
It was always basketball. I mean, in grade school, we were able to just sort of play a number of things in school. So like we had school teams and, you know, baseball, football, basketball. Those were like the main three. But in terms of organized sports, basketball was the first and only one.
Were you always in St. Louis?
No. So I've only been in St. Louis for about 6 years. And I moved there for graduate school. I mean, I've kind of lived in a number of different cities. So prior to that, I was in Portland, Oregon, which is another pretty big basketball town, actually. But the thing about basketball for this show in particular, like in St. Louis, is that it was just the recognition that there was kind of a shortage of outdoor basketball courts in like very public places. So namely like R. Forest Park, which is, they always claim that it's, and it is, bigger square footage wise than Central Park in New York City. And it houses most of our cultural institutions. So it has our art museum, like our big sort of encyclopedic art museum, our history museum, the zoo is there, you know, an outdoor playhouse. So everything's there. There's a golf course also, and a number of other outdoor activities. So there's rugby fields, there's handball courts, there's an area that is a volleyball area in the summer and an ice skating rink in the winter. So there are all of these outdoor activities that one can engage in, but like no basketball courts. And it was really, at first I was like, oh, that's interesting, but I assumed that there had to be one. And I was kind of in this debate with a friend of mine. It was like, no, there has to be, definitely. And then there was something that was released by, he's a musician who's from, born and raised in St. Louis. And he released something called like, you know, the 10 most racist things about St. Louis. And one of them was no basketball courts in Forest Park. And so I was like, okay, so yeah, this is certain. This is something that people are aware of. This is something that, you know, someone growing up notices and recognizes as like a problem and a kind of curious one. So that would just, for me, like the outdoor court, you know, especially as someone who moved around a lot, was always a place for like, you know, socialization and like, you know, finding community, you know, particularly like finding a friend base. And so it was just kind of curious and interesting to me that was like missing from such a public environment.
You have created basketball courts in a gallery.
Yeah. So yeah, the initial installation or iteration of this show, which was at the Contemporary Art Museum in St. Louis as a part of a biennial program for emerging artists. And I knew that obviously, you know, talking about Forest Park, I really wanted to address the outdoor problem. And so blacktop or asphalt was obviously the first choice, but you know, there were a number of reasons that I would suspect they wouldn't let me do that. And then, you know, the more people I told, they were like, they're never gonna let you do that. They're gonna have to like destroy the building afterwards. But luckily the curator that I was working with had experience with it before, so I didn't have to do any advocacy to get it involved. He had experience and he was like, no, that can't be any other way. This is what has to be done. So yeah, they figured out a way to do it without damaging the space. I mean, everyone got a day off of work, so they were like pleased about that. But yeah, I mean, I really think that just that transformation of the space, bringing the outside inside, I think for a lot of people, that really kind of, I guess, struck them in terms of what I was addressing and really sort of drove it home.
Any movement on getting a court?
No. There, you know, there's actually in other parts of the city. So there are like courts kind of scattered around St. Louis. Not so much in the city that I've seen. It's mostly been sort of, I mean, St. Louis is broken up into, you know, 92 municipalities. It's like a real problem that there's so much of the county that is considered the city of St. Louis, you know, sort of in people's minds. But like myself, I live near, you know, Washington University, and I'm right on the city-county line of University City and St. Louis City. So in University City, there are public courts. And in the city, there's a shortage. And there is one case on the south side, actually, at Cherokee Street, which now is kind of a strip where there are a lot of, like, artist-run spaces. Like, it's kind of a popular area of the city for people to congregate. There is an empty lot next to a business in which the community has actually formed kind of like a makeshift court. And it's just short of full court size, but there's one, I believe, pole that's installed in the ground, and there's another portable, like, opposite. And there have been a lot of moves to, like, make this an official court, and they've actually met some resistance. But I think recently they got accepted in terms of, like, developing it. So that was, like, a win. You know, I briefly spoke to the person who was kind of organizing that. And it seemed like, you know, she was really making progress in terms of making it a thing. But it's wonderful to, like, walk past that. There's always kids playing on that court, you know, and it's really amazing to see. And, you know, the portable one has, you know, sandbags on it to keep it upright. And, you know, these kids are out there probably every day playing on it, which I think speaks volumes to, like, what could be happening elsewhere.
Going back to those early days when you were in school and growing up, what was it about basketball particularly? Was it the speed? Was it the dynamism of that?
I think so. I think it was, because it's funny, the two sports that I enjoy watching the most are basketball and hockey, oddly enough. And hockey wasn't something I'd ever really played. Like, when rollerblading was a thing, I played roller hockey. And was always really interested in, like, you know, hockey films and stuff. You know, the Mighty Ducks was huge. But yeah, basketball, there was something about, I think also its relationship to footwear and apparel was also a huge draw. So it was kind of those things. And as I was kind of coming up, probably much before that, actually, maybe the generation before me, but I feel like that kind of Michael Jordan generation was the one, or maybe just before him, was the one in which signature footwear became really, you know, iconic and significant. And that, I think, brought a lot more people, young people, to the sport.
And at what point did you start thinking and incorporating images of basketball into your work? Because we look online and we see your portraits and your character studies and all those things.
Yeah, I believe maybe 7 years ago, in terms of work that kind of falls in line with my current thinking, maybe 7 years ago was the first time I was looking at basketball players and kind of recontextualizing them in some way. So I did a couple of images of two NBA players. These were oil paintings, and I kind of redesigned their uniforms to be a bit more formal. And that kind of went away, but then came back actually later when I started to really think about a similar sort of concept, but through a different medium, but also thinking about just costume in general. And so between these different kinds of archetypes, so thinking about, like, athletes, superheroes, but then also this idea of, like, gentlemanly dress, and how each of these three sort of characters, if you will, are very much concerned with appearance and what they have on, and in many cases, what they're wearing, you know, sort of provides the transformation to whatever that sort of quality is going to be.
There are those schools of acting where people put on a hat and become that way, right?
Yeah, the prop. Yeah, you need the prop to sort of activate the experience, yeah.
I thought it was cool when I read what you were thinking about when you read that anthropologist from Australia and the concept of color.
So the author is Michael Taussig, an anthropologist, spends a lot of time in South America, actually, and has done a lot of research on kind of visual culture in South America. And the first book of his that I was put onto is called Beauty and the Beast. So he talks about a number of different things as they pertain to one's appearance, but also, like, sort of collecting and acquiring things and, like, what it means to collect, and, like, talking about status and, you know, sort of social mobility and all of these things. But then I was just kind of really interested in his writing style and looking at other titles, and I came across this book, What Color is the Sacred? And reading the description, it was just really fascinating. And then once I started reading, I was like, whoa, this is, like, really incredible. Like, I've never really thought about color, not only in, like, the kind of historical and cultural sense, but also in the colonial sense, and like how color was viewed, or just observations that he makes about how color is perceived, the distinction between the sort of Western, quote unquote, more civilized, sophisticated societies and the more, quote unquote, primitive and uncivilized societies in the communities that they were to colonize. I kind of happened upon that as I was trying to figure out how I was going to not only construct these sculptures, but also how to organize them, because they really are based on, or they come from, the collection of magazine imagery that I have. And of course, in magazine advertising and even in features, it kind of goes back and forth between black and white and full color. And so that was the one question. And I was like, how do I organize this? How do I make a decision in terms of like what goes, you know, how do I organize, you know, the photography across different sculptures? And this was that book or that reading, you know, thinking about desaturation versus saturation really helped me kind of organize the two teams.
The technical artistic media that you use and color separation and those things that do then contribute to our experience that you're trying to give us. Mm-hmm. You do write about that.
Yeah, so the four color process involved in commercial printing. So the separation of, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, CMYK. That also started, well, prior to this work, where I was just using, it was kind of when I was first starting to work with these images, you know, that I had amassed over the years. I have this like digital archive, and I went to another residency, and I was like, this was maybe in 2014. And I was just like, you know, I'm going to go there. I'm not going to bring any materials, just like these virtual images, and figure out what I want to do with them. Some of the works that I made were just taking croppings or, you know, altered edits and kind of just placing different images together just to kind of produce these weird photographic juxtapositions. And it was kind of an interest. It was like partially intentional, but partially to kind of save, to make good use of like a bad quality image in some cases. But I realized that when I was scanning them, like I could see the colored dots, and I kind of liked that quality. And as I started to use other images and really dealing with resizing and scaling, that sort of quality would get distorted. So I started imposing it and sort of adding that half tone, that dot matrix filter to everything. I guess what many of the images were images of sort of well-designed consumer items. So either, you know, really stylish objects or clothing from, you know, fashion ads or whatever, or things that the magazine was featuring. And it occurred to me that I had this sort of draw to the image of the thing that I guess took priority over needing the thing itself. And so there was this moment in which the image of the object takes over for the object itself. And, you know, so that got me to really thinking about the image as a material, and emphasizing the dot matrix really brings that out. You know, it sort of makes it very apparent that we're looking at something that's been constructed, something that's not real, something that is a representation. And so, yeah, I guess exposing the dots sort of talk about the material of print. You know, it really exposes what these things are made out of, and also points to just how influential something that is knowingly fake. It's sort of like theater in that way. You know, it's like we know that they're actors, but it's like we still go along with them, you know, even when they're talking to us.
And so is there some political subtext there that we should, as people who are living in the 21st century, need to educate our eyes?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, you know, and that's like kind of a direct tie back to, you know, Michael's writing. He's thinking about perceptions on color and what is refined and what is primitive. And for me, the makeup of printing is like a really nice, anecdote to that dynamic, because you have these four sort of distinct dot patterns that come together and form an image. You know, they're in resolution, you know, and that's really interesting. And I'm still fascinated by it when I'm looking at these images. I'm like, God, this works. Like, it's amazing that this works. The sort of optical mixing works in that way. You know, I say that it's a metaphor for a desire for, you know, for how I would like the world to operate. It's also important to note out that even the so-called black and white images are also made up of these four colored dots. So when you get close to them, you realize that, you know, a kind of neutrality comes from all of these things coming together. So everything is of color, hence the title. You know, it's not just color versus black and white. It's like we're all living in a chromatic world. I find it fascinating. Yeah. So I hope it's interesting.
But also, you've talked about how your sculptural pieces, when they're on pedestals, is part of a tradition, a sculptural tradition,
right?
Yeah,
absolutely, yes. I mean, I think that's something that I've really been thinking about lately, too, is like, in addition to drawing all of these things from the world into sort of an arts context, I'm also like addressing arts context like specifically. So I'm really thinking about a tradition of the way sculpture is presented, and I'm thinking about, and now like with painting also, because like there are some, my background's actually in painting. And so now that I'm kind of going back to painting and making images again, I'm sort of drawing from the same sort of logic or process that the printings are made. So I'm making paintings out of, you know, a limited palette of CMYK, and in some cases making images with the toner pigment that the photos are printed out of. So for me, it's really about like kind of two contexts coming together. So both the world context and the art context. And that's also, I guess, where basketball comes into play. Because I mean, this work is three things that I'm kind of obsessed with that really come together. So athletics, art, and then magazines.
The other thing about basketball is that there is that sense of gravity and also flight.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah. And yes. And, you know, again, when I was thinking about athletes, superheroes, in that connection, like flight really was a big thing that I had to kind of focus on. That whole comparison or that juxtaposition of those three things was like the foundation of my thesis writing in graduate school. And the work that I ended up making out of it, it was kind of like a boutique or like dressing room that kind of fused all of these three things. And that was where I first started to make these new kind of altered photographs of NBA players wearing different clothing. Yeah, that is the whole thing. You know, that whole defying gravity and being in the air and, you know, that momentary flight. It's it's dazzling.
it also could be dance, like there's poetry there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and it's much more of a kind of I think like your mind has to mature as you're, it's interesting. And I think about, I always go back to Michael Jordan, because he is, you know, arguably still greatest. But I think it's because of how he was able to kind of adapt his game in a very elegant way to compensate for what he was maybe losing in physicality. And so that's like a really, yeah, that's an interesting thing for me. You know, he was sort of known for his jumping ability when he was younger, and then he became known for kind of marksmanship and being able to like shoot really well and shoot really well in kind of uncomfortable positions, kind of jumping away from the basket, which is like, you don't do that. It's just, and it's one of those things you can't really defend against if someone's really good at it. I think it does speak to that kind of poetry that you're talking about, because to watch it is, it's kind of a magical thing.
And the whole sense, too, you're working on screens with digital images and so forth. But this is so physical. This is so embodied.
Yeah.
There is that contrast, too.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's also a bit of an interesting kind of contradiction, because I do think about the images that are cutouts, because the whole sculptures are made up of cutout magazine images that are kind of propped on boxes that you would find toner cartridges or printer components in. And they're acting as the pedestals. So that's one of the ways I'm just kind of maybe deviating from our traditional sense of what a pedestal is or what sculpture on a pedestal looks like. But yeah, I think of them as flat sculptures, and that they kind of go between being two-dimensional and three-dimensional. They kind of exist there simultaneously. And I think this kind of reproduction, the image of an object, functions the same way for me. So this is, again, kind of emphasizing that fact, or the way that I experience those things in terms of like it being an image, but I still can hold it. You know, it's something that I can own. But yeah, even in that, like the making of those things, like all of those things are cut by hand. That's incredibly labor intensive and kind of idiotic on my part to kind of submit myself to that process. I mean, anyone who goes will see, yeah, when you see all of the different components, you know, you see all of those things, that all those images that have been cut out and they're mounted on kind of a hardened board, you know, my hands touched every one of those things.
Now, Heather, as gallery director, why did you think it was great to have this show, and what would you like folks from this area to experience?
Of course, yeah. Well, I think about the Sordoni as first and foremost an alternative classroom for Wilkes. So I'm thinking first about our student body, and I'm thinking also about ways to have different aspects of our student body engage with our gallery. And I thought this show was a wonderful bridge, how we were even just talking about the idea of athletes and how the athletic culture on a campus is enormous. Mm. And we also know that in our own community here, how the athletic culture is enormous. And the idea of that, of taking something that we're so very familiar with, something that we all know and love, and maybe experiencing it in a different way, allowing it to access our, some of our experiences that way, has us able to look at some of the content that Lyndon is presenting to us. So it's just a different way to kind of, a different entry point into the content that he's talking about.
How can we see it? Where can we see it?
Well, it's at the Sordoni Gallery on Wilkes University campus. It's in the Stark Learning Center, which is at 150 South River Street. We're open Tuesday through Sunday from 12 to 4:30, and we'll be open until May 21st. So we're all through into, you know, right after commencement. So if you're coming to campus for any sort of end of year events, definitely stop by. It's, you know, a really great show to take a look at.
Heather Sienkiewicz, director of the Sordoni Gallery, speaking with us, and award-winning artist Lyndon Barois Jr. from St. Louis about his installation of color now at the Sordoni Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre through May 21st. Gallery hours Tuesday through Sunday, noon to 4:30. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery, S-O-R-D-O-N-I, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery. The exhibition will be accompanied by a catalog published by the Sordoni Gallery featuring an essay written by poet and writer in residence at Washington University at St. Louis, Francine J. Harris, and that's available at the gallery. Of Color, featuring the work of artist Lyndon Barois Jr., and Barois is spelled B-A-R-R-O-I-S, Lyndon Barois Jr. from St. Louis, Of Color, now at the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre through May 21st, gallery hours Tuesdays through Sundays, noon to 4:30. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery.